I'm Stephen Mead, I'm the moderator for tonight. Hope you'll have an understanding conversation for the I've been involved in the internet for quite some time, actually since 1993, when I suspect some of the people who come to use up to that, I had 10 megabit access to a 45 megabit backbone. And then a few years later, I did. And I've been suffering since. So I've had some personal interest. Then I create connectivity by everybody, individuals, businesses, community organizations, people sitting in this room. The panel we'll put here tonight has some fascinating variations on what the problems is, how people can help, how the government can help or not, and what people are doing individually, and what some of us have not sure, maybe some ideas I'd like to present. We've actually pre-arranged what they agreed themselves in consensus. It's an excellent thing. I was resorting to the hand over head, but they agreed among themselves to present. Our first presenter will be Jordan Carter, policy director of the UNZ, and also the UNZ Climate Sponsor tonight. We have Jamie Patton, who's general manager at EPICS, EPICS Networks, who's a marketplace organization with a very large private network and these operations in Zealand. We have Donald Clark, who's Chief Executive Officer of Reant, and you may have known Reant by their network called Carrot, which is really exciting, you know, the comments and events, so hopefully we'll be announcing soon. And finally, we have Lance Wicks, who's co-founder of this platform. Now, the format is tonight is each of approximately 5 minutes. We are a little bit time constrained, so the focus will be about four on the subjects which did arrange themselves. It's not for us, it's not talking what to talk about. Approximately 5 minutes each. If there's a little bit over time, we'll try and cut them off. And then the main part is after 5 minutes each, we have 20, 30 minutes of interaction questions. We want questions or comments or statements from the floor. You can address them to an individual, or if you're not sure, you can address them to me and I'll randomly pick or whoever I think may be most appropriate based on my knowledge. So to say, stand up, they'll throw your mind. And finally, the things we have to talk about. In case of emergency, likely that you need to go first, down to the left, and down the stairs. The toilet's in the center to the left, and then to the left. And you've already got internet access, so that's probably one of the most important things that doesn't work. So, let's go. Good luck.
Thank you, Stephen. Do I need to use the microphone? I can see you guys here tonight. But I can see you. I want to just ask a couple of questions before I decide whether I'm actually going to give this presentation or try to get. Who would you describe yourself as broadband policy experts? That's a good start. Okay. So the reason I call me first is because I thought I might give a highly political broadcast for a national party. To you, or them, what the government is doing in urban broadband and rural broadband, and which hopefully you don't know, if you do know, you can start listening to the government. And the reason for that is quite simple. We were all sort of talking about 2 years ago about how great it would be persuade a political party in New Zealand that fibre to the premises was a good idea, that getting rid of both the key bandwidth constraints that face people in their homes and in their businesses. Was great. And then some short guy came along, gave a speech, and said that they would do it. He's now the Prime Minister, and it's about 18 months later. They're starting to do it with two initiatives. One is an ultra-fast broadband initiative, aimed at the towns down to Nelson. I think that's smaller than that. And a rural package to wrap up the rest. And that was quite a change. Until then, New Zealand governments had said, copper-based, whatever the market will provide. This new government suddenly oddly said, the market won't provide, so the government will. We're here to help. Here's 1.5 billion money. So what are they going to do with it? The more interesting one for me, because I live in Wellington, is the urban plan. 75% of premises, more or less, are meant to get fiber to the premises. Now, the other guy's going to talk about why fiber to the premises doesn't fix all of your speed constraints, but I can see that because they're going to do it. And the idea is quite clever. Some of the work in Treasury came up with the idea about the commercial model, which we're going to get. But basically, the government's going to partner with somewhere between 1 and 33 different organizations to build somewhere between 1 and 33 separate fiber networks in 33 distinct areas. And the idea is that sometime over the next 10 years, someone will come down your street, take a hold of the private pay alert, and I'll give you a chance to connect. This is a good thing. 1.5 billion is designed to basically say, no one is building this now. The market isn't going to build it in a timely fashion. We think consumers need this high-speed connectivity. So we'll speed it up. So your tax dollars are going to speed up the investment. That may have happened anyway at some distance in the future. And while 10 years sounds distant, if you listen to some of the telcos, it's a lot quicker than we would have got there without some public intervention. So they're going to focus on school buildings first, and hospitals, regional councils, and other public facilities. But that's going to all be building the infrastructure that will get fiber out to the streets. And the virtual model is basically the government pays for the cables down the streets, as the providers mentioned. So if you want the service, they put the money back to the government to buy out its investment as a connection on the highway. So 1.5 billion is actually more than that. The OBS paid back. We'll go out and get investments in all kinds of things. So that's the 75%. And as we all know, as we're all farmers in this room, all the money and all the worthwhile things in New Zealand happen in rural areas. So the government thought, well, we should do something there as well. And the basic story is they want to fiber to 97% of schools and let people build off from those points of fiber high speed presence, whatever they want to do. Whether it's better cellular blow up coverage, whether it's fixed Wi-Fi, whether it is wealthy farmers sort of laying a fiber to schools to connect. The idea is that communities will spontaneously sort this out, which is great. And that's going to be paid for by an empty foundation of $50 million of taxpayers' money, and $250 million is going to be raised from the telco industry by a levy. You may have noticed a couple of weeks ago that we announced Telecom's share price, believe it or not, came slightly further. Many were expecting that, and we just know that that has been stripped off. So, if this all works, in a number of years, you'll have someone coming to your door in the city saying, we'd like to pay you to this magnificent fiber. If you happen to live in a tiny little settlement, you will hopefully find that local school has broadband. That may not be of interest to you. But if it does, your mobile broadband should get better. And maybe some entrepreneur in small towns will offer a chance to connect the Wi-Fi to something else. It's quite a good story. I think it's quite admirable given, you know, from an internet perspective, this wouldn't be happening without a reasonably bold decision that doesn't allow the cost benefit analysis, but takes away the fact that if you give fees to unconstrained broadband without the speed of that side issues we've got today, good things will happen because we've created new people like those in this room. And that's a lot of stuff. Thank you.
So it's almost like our first model for the life safety service. So next is Ben from the next one.
Yeah, I think I'll share it as well on the itself. The order of space is just one bit of logical set framework around what governments are doing. In terms of providing access to the urban and rural areas. And the other unit that we see is that I'm sure once we have national capacity. So that's what I'm doing, first question, what's the biggest problem for them with this number?
Tackle.
A lot?
No, here it is, of course.
A lot? Yeah. Exactly the same thoughts as I had, right? The common denominator is that affordability.
Would you mind casting your voice just a tad further?
Okay.
Thank you.
The common thing, first of all, is the common thing is basically what it boils down to is affordability.
And one of the curious things about New Zealand and Australia is the fact that we've got this thing called volume-based pricing. I mean, recently you've got companies like Comcast and other ISPs in the States looking at volume-based pricing, but it was actually quite a unique thing developed in New Zealand. Really, when the internet turned up, and I think if you do enough Googling, you'll end up landing on a page or a paper written by a wonderful gentleman called Neville Brownlee. And the reason why we developed volume pricing is because it boils down to this. And I ask another question. Any guesses out there what people think are wholesale rates at a moderate sort of buying scale for international capacity in this country? Per megabit. Per megabit. About $150 if you're buying at significant scale.
What's the menu there?
Hundreds and hundreds of megabits.
Right? So is that for a swap or is that for what are you talking about?
We're talking about a generic IP international transit out of the country.
Per megabit set for megabits. So can
per megabit set for
$150 for a month, can I do a megabit tracker 24 hours sealed?
Absolutely. Right. Now, here's the other thing. In the US, buying at the same scale, it's heavy use.
16.
$5 a megabit. And that's not even really trying and working your suppliers that hard. So you can automatically see that the wholesale rates for international capacity are orders of magnitude different between the US and New Zealand. Yet at the same time, you look at our peers, people like us in the US, and they've got plans at a price like this, and we think, we'd like some of that. The thing is that we're on the longest last mile in the world. It's called the South Pacific Cable. So the price at the moment, we hope that another one will turn up soon. And I suppose the question is, okay, if the question is affordability, one of the answers could be laid on the cable. But what I wanted to highlight tonight is some elements of the market that I think we need to address. It would be really good to address first, or at least seek out that particular answer. And one of the things, as Hamish mentioned before, is differentiated pricing. I heard someone else say about local content. Yet, generally speaking, at a retail level, we're paying per volume, per gigabyte. Doesn't matter where you go, we go national, international, it's all the same price. So you've got no incentive, A, to connect locally and connect to local services. But the other thing that it creates is you've got effectively bundled pricing between the expensive bit, which is the Trans-Pacific, and the relatively cheap bit, which is domestic connectivity. So what does that stop? Well, the internet at the end of the day, plain vanilla internet access is a commodity market. But because of bundled pricing, because there's no benefit in connecting to other international providers locally, you can't create what's known in the mature markets as a spot market. If I'm at home on my gigabyte plan and I've got 20 gigs on the plan and I'm about to run out, why can't I connect to another international provider that's in New Zealand that happens to have international capacity available at a cheap rate? Because they're selling to a certain sector, let's say the ISP is sold to the business sector, guess what? Their international capacity is already paid for, sitting there doing nothing at night. Why can't residential or domestic customers connect to that ISP and make use of the capacity on an opportunistic basis? And then you have, when you enable that kind of market, you have a much more fluid arrangement going on. Where you're able to connect customers to capacity very easily. And the reason why that's quite important in the context of what Lance and his team are up to is if that was to happen, if you have differentiated pricing, if the fluid spot market develops, the capacity that we've already paid for becomes available to the domestic market so much more easily. Why am I bringing this out? I think it's a really good idea to exhaust that possibility first, because it'd be an awful thing to spend however many million dollars on another international cable, and then the spot market turns up, changing the demand equation for the second cable. So that's why I want to talk about it tonight, is to get a bit of certainty about what the business case looks like when the second cable does turn up. Just on the second cable itself, FX buy a little bit of capacity here and there, internationally speaking. We think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. that the team at Pacific Fibre are talking about doing this thing. Although, I think another landing point at Auckland, my bet's on Tauranga and Nelson. Two reasons for that. One of the reasons is that there's a reason why there's a cable bay in Nelson. If any of you have studied submarine topology, I guess you could call it, geology, there's a thing called the Lord Howe Rise. And it's a great big shallow area that goes from Nelson in an arc up towards just near Sydney. Excellent place to lay a cable. It's cheap. You don't spend lots of money on sending it under the water. It sort of goes a little bit then along. And the other thing, the other reason for that is it'd be quite a good idea to get South Island as a redundant connection point for the rest of the country rather than Auckland. The reason why Tauranga versus Auckland, well, it's a nice place. It's one of the fastest cities in the North Island. And for any of you who have spent some time up in Albany around where the current Trans-Pacific Cable is landing, you'll know that an awful lot of development comes out about that proximity to that capacity. It's like a little mini sort of Silicon Valley bit. So you have a few thoughts, somewhat scattered, but I'm sure I can use up for 5 minutes, so there you go, sir.
And it's got nothing to do with the weather or the beaches in Tauranga.
Good evening, everyone. Lovely to see you all. I had the good fortune for somebody to pay me to go to Abu Dhabi last week. It was great. I had the bad fortune to contract some sort of quite violent GI issues on my return. One thing I always do when I go to other countries to speak, which I get to engage with the international research and education network community quite a lot, is to put New Zealand in perspective. So I have this little slide where I centre on Wellington on Google Earth, and I zoom out to a hemisphere view of the world. Okay? And I use Wolfram Alpha, which is wicked, and I sort of try and look at the population of what you can see, right, in that hemisphere view of the world. Now, if you sort of take, say, half of Papua New Guinea has just been visible, any guesses, and Jim, you're welcome to guess, on how many million people are in a hemispherical view of the world centered on Wellington? Pretty close. I reckon 30 to 100, depending on how much of Papua New Guinea you take in. Indonesia, I mean. Yeah. No, so there's 221 million in Indonesia, but 30 to 100 million, depending on where you draw the line. And then centered on Dubai, zoomed out to a hemispherical view of the world. Population that you can see? Like 5 or 6 billion. Right? So I do that, and the reason I do that is because, and I'm not going to talk about the international capacity anymore, but the challenge of networking New Zealand to the rest of the world is fundamentally harder. Right, you've got a city-sized population in the arse end of nowhere. You know, when you're on a plane, you don't accidentally get diverted to Auckland when you find international.
There's a fog in Sydney. What is that? Divert to Auckland?
Okay, it doesn't happen. Right, they're so far away. So my international colleagues sort of say, well, "That's great. Donald, you need to be a part of these experiments. You need to set up some trans-Pacific light paths to do some 10 gig fiber astronomy networking." I said, "Sure. Let's just do the numbers on that." So I asked my colleagues. I said, "Rene and some of the guys, Case neighbors in the Netherlands." I said, "You guys always buy this networking stuff. Oh, we're in the market just now, so I said, that's super. How much for 10 gig?" Service per year across the North Atlantic.
That's about 100,000 euro a year.
And I went, wow, okay, 100,000 euros a year. Let's say that's 120,000, 130,000 US per year. Distance answers down to New York City, about half the distance from the west coast of New Zealand. So let's double that price. Okay. Now let's be favourable and let's say Southern Cross is an awesome resilient network. It's a very well engineered network. So let's double it again for some resiliency. So that's a 4 times multiplier on that price. So per year, we were 400,000 or 500,000 US. Okay, would be the equivalent cost. So right now, 10-year IRUs on Southern Cross are roughly $49 million US dollars. I make that $4.9 million US dollars per year. right? So with a 4x multiplier on the transatlantic, north transatlantic price, right, we're still a factor of 10 order of magnitude cost differential, right, on those prices. Now it's a very hard business case. Well, that's the people land it and all the rest of it. So that's an underestimate of the actual cost differential. So New Zealand research and education is constrained in its ability what it can do. I can't even have a single high definition uncompressed video conferencing stream, because while you've got 4, 5, 6 megs for a compressed HD stream, an uncompressed 1080p HD stream is 1.2 gigabits a second through the same channels, and we can't do that, so we just can't do some things. Sergey, when he was astronomy connected, telescope connected, starting sending data down there. Right now I only have a 155 to Sydney, that's going to go up to a gigabit pipe, but that was maxed out for 8 hours last Sunday with him just sending data. So it's being used, but we need a lot more. So that brings me to the second part I want to sort of set the scene with, and that's our role on the demand side. You've heard a lot about supply, the government's investing in the supply side, the Jamie's business is providing the infrastructure, and Lance's business hopefully will be providing infrastructure. Rian's job is actually not to supply infrastructure, our job is to act on the purchase side, so we're a demand aggregator. So we take all the money and sort of like try and suck it out of the universities, the polytechs, the schools increasingly, you know, maybe the library sector next as well. And we try and take those dollars to marketplace and say, guys, you know, this education market, this research, they never have any money. Well, they've given it all to us now, right? And that lets us do two things. We're then their agent, and it's much easier when you're talking as one agent against 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 suppliers than when you're talking against 10, 20, 40, 200, right? Buyers against 3 or 4 suppliers. Okay, so the power balance redresses itself. The second thing it allows us to do is to impose some of our will on the marketplace. So rather than saying to the market and then saying, well, doll, this is what we offer, we say, well, do you know, that's not really good enough. Okay, and come on, it's for the kids. That's for education. And, you know, we get prices out of the suppliers. I have to legally sign that I will not disclose, because we know they are sometimes orders of magnitude different than an offer in the marketplace. Okay, but we can impose architectures, we can set high levels of ambition. So connected cameras since 2006, you could only do so at the core, basically by a dark fiber. So Telstra Clear came up with a managed fiber product. It's not fiber, they don't talk about it. You know, there are other people, so we are stimulating demand. And I guess what's really important to understand is that as we go forward, the business cases for rolling out fiber in New Zealand is not easy. The business case for deploying international capacity and New Zealand additional capacity is very hard as well. So Rian's has been used by the public sector several times, and international and national, to act as that demand aggregator to try and de-risk the business case of these investments and to try and accelerate the market. So, my point. Let's get booted on. Yeah.
And the last question of the one part of the presentation will be secured for the question between the lines so far. I think we've heard the reason why we want capacity. I think we've heard what we can do inside New Zealand to help alleviate the capacity issue. I think we've heard that the demand is high, and gee, wouldn't it be nice if it was a lot higher? And I guess it comes to the reason that we started Pacific Fibre, and that is that we had the same frustration that we all in this room had, and that is we just want high-speed internet where there are no caps. And high-speed internet today is, that we get in New Zealand, is not high-speed internet. What we want is the ability to do HD video, you know, simultaneously, everyone in this room, from this building to somewhere in the rest of the world. In fact, we want to do it at 20k resolution. In fact, we want to do it at the next resolution up above that. We don't actually know what we want to do, frankly. But what we do know is that the capacity is just going to keep rising. So that's the preamble. What I want to do is, while I'm talking, I'll hand out these are sample cables from Tyco, they call themselves Subcom now. And what you'll see is there's an outer core, which is plastic. Then there's a copper piece, which is where the power goes, that powers repeaters that are about every 50 kilometers or so. Then there's some steel, which is there for structural integrity and strength. Inside that, there's another little plastic sheet. And inside that, and that particular one, are 8 fiber optic cables. And at the moment, our plan is to do 4 of those. So imagine that, 14,000 kilometers of that. And sometimes it's thicker than that when it goes across rocks and that sort of stuff. And sometimes you bury it when it gets near land and so on and so forth. You actually want to have it deep, not shallow, because apart from the giant squid problem, there really isn't that much that when it's deep that it's going to break the cable. So what I want to do is give you a brief update of where we are. So the why we want to do this is because we believe, and Southern Cross said it themselves, that capacity just keeps on rising. It's been rising by 35% a year for a while now. The price has been falling by about 23% a year, says Southern Cross. And you do the math, and that's a 4% per year increase in an overall take. We believe that an order of magnitude change is required in terms of the amount of capacity available to us. We also believe that we are getting to the pipe, and that we need to fix, well, not we, other people need to fix the rest of the problem, which is the backhaul and which is the connectivity to the door. Okay, so we're not working on those problems, we're just working on the international connectivity problem. So, where we are, there are 3 things we're trying to do all at the same time. And they are to raise money. We need $500 million, which is down a bit from what we originally estimated, and it might be down a bit further. We need to sell enough capacity so that we can go out and raise the money. And we need to actually specify that cable, go through a bunch of processes and select a vendor, and then get it built. So we need to do all 3 of those things at the same time, and we need to do them in increasing levels of seriousness, for want of a better word. Okay? So where we are right now, we're currently at round 3 of our financing. It's still pretty much a wealthy individual's kind of affair. We're extending the people that we're reaching out to bring into the team. We'll come to the public with that when that happens. So the financing side is going well. The technology side, we've received, I love this industry, we've received BROM and ROMs. So a ROM is a very rough order of magnitude quote, and a ROM is a rough order of magnitude quote. We've received those from a couple of vendors, at least, and we've got other ones coming. And the vendors are telling us what they can do and so on and so forth. And we need to decide in the next 2 or 3 months which configuration we're going to do. Are we going to split out to Tauranga, or Nelson, or the two lands in Auckland, or Melbourne, or whatever? We need to figure out all that stuff and decide on the plan. And then we can press the go button on the RFP. The final phase is sales. And that's part of the figuring out where we land. If we sell, for example, into Brisbane, and someone's willing to pass a lot of money, then hey, we'll go to Brisbane, no problem. So we need to get those sales lined up so that we know kind of what to do, so that we can go and raise the money. And as you can see, it's just this dance. So Mark Rossworth and John Humphrey. So Mark's leading sales, John's leading the technical side, and I'm the finance guy at the moment. They were over at Suboptic just now in Tokyo, and we were the newest project over there. We were the longest project, and we were the first 40 gigabit per second per wavelength project. So it was all very exciting for the guys, and we had incredible feedback from vendors who really wanted to get on board, from consultants who reached out to us in an amazing number of ways and said, hey, we'd love to help. And also, it's really pleasing, obviously, from customers who said, hey, we'd love to buy some capacity, let's talk and let's go through that process. And so on the capacity buying process, the way it works is you have those conversations, you eventually sign letters of intent, you sign contracts of increasing kind of durability, and these kind of things are for 10 gigabits a second, they're in the kind of, you mentioned $40, $50 million before. These are the sorts of numbers that get thrown around in this sort of project.